Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Varsha.
And today on the pod, we are going to talk about yet another mass shooting. And then the education department wants to now use federal money to buy firearms for schools. I don't think the two stories are necessarily related, but it's hard not to notice the flashing red sign about gun law that links these two things together. We're also going to talk a little bit about healthcare and what's going on with the ACA. And nothing's definite, but it's very interesting because there's a group of Republican senators who are trying to, quote, protect portions of the ACA. It's a fascinating story. And we are going to talk about the attempted suppression of votes in Georgia and its ultimate failure. So lots to get to today, but before we jump in, Varsha, we have a huge announcement that I've been dying to make.
I'm very excited for this announcement, too.
No, I've been kind of dancing around it and sort of hinting at it in my gratitude checks for the last 2 weeks, which is just an annoying amount of time to not say something. So I would like to announce that Hellbent Media is producing two new shows, one in conjunction with Crush the Midterms and one in conjunction with Emily's List. So I will be hosting both shows, and Varsha and I will be producing both shows. Crush the Midterms, I'm going to be co-hosting with Marissa Cabus, who's been on the show a few times here. Then we're going to be talking about activism running up to the midterms. They're both going to be limited run series, so they're both going to be 10-episode series in the run-up to the midterms. So like I said, Crush the Midterms will be about the activism side, and the Emily's List show called Candidate, like candid conversations with women running for office, is going to focus on the candidates running and issues related to that. So those will be starting to come out starting next week.
Woo!
We're going to release them on this feed, so you'll get them in addition to our normal shows. They'll be dropping on Tuesdays, but they will also be their own standalone shows. So I'll remind you again, if you want to go subscribe to that, to those two shows, it's going to be an amazing journey. I am so excited. I'm so lucky to be working with these amazing organizations to put out content that's important and useful and really focuses on the issues. And it's cool because it's a different enough format from this show, where it's kind of a new challenge for you and I, Varsha.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. And also for listeners, we're going to listen to these new shows. It's really important to share them, not just because obviously you love Hellbent Media and it's the first rule of feminism, but also because exactly as Devin said, they're going to be really useful. They'll be really cool insights into like candidates, but also just insights into like how do you be the best activist you can be in 2018 right. In the hellscape that we live. And right. how do you be a really great political actor in the 21st century. And I think the two shows are just going to be really great.
I'm really, really excited about it. Sutton Basket has been rated the number one meal kit by leading publications, and it's no wonder why. They offer 18 weekly recipes with options for paleo, gluten-free, Mediterranean, lean and clean, vegan, and more. But for me, what matters is that Sunbasket helps me eat healthier, and I'm a terrible cook and I can still do it. Sunbasket makes it easy and convenient to cook healthy, delicious meals at home, no matter how much experience you have in the kitchen, which for me is zero. I also don't have to go to the grocery store, which is very important. And now you get more options than ever. Just go to the Sunbasket app and pick from the 18 weekly recipes. Sunbasket works with the best farms and suppliers to bring you fresh, organic produce and responsibly raised meats and seafood. Everything is pre-measured and easy to prep, and you don't have to go to the grocery store. I can't accentuate that enough. You can get a healthy and delicious meal on the table in about 30 minutes. So go to sunbasket.com/hellbent today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/hellbent for $35 off. sunbasket.com/hellbent. All right, Varsha. So before we jump into the news, I want to take a minute to talk about John McCain, who passed from brain cancer. And there's been a lot of talk about it on Twitter. And I think we just wanted to sort of talk our way through it a little bit. So do you want to tell me your feelings?
Yeah. So obviously Twitter isn't the best place for nuance and calm discussions. But basically, I'm just going to be honest. As soon as I saw the notification on my phone, I felt sad. And I felt sad the day before when the family announced that John McCain was no longer going to continue seeking treatment, right? Like, I felt right. sad. No matter everything I know about the man, I know about his policies. I know about what he championed. I know about what he didn't champion. I know what he said. I still felt sad. And so my feeling was, and it might sound hypocritical to some people, it might sound frustrating, but when people online were just like, why should I mourn someone who is responsible for the death of millions of people? I was like, that's fair, but that was a valid yeah. policy choice at the time. And hundreds of other senators and Congress people voted for the same war. And so if you can't mourn John McCain, that means no one, no politician who was a politician in 2000 and 2003 should be mourned ever, right? And that if you can have that view, fine. But I don't know how you can have that view. And I think John McCain is one of the few senators that over time has been able to actually own up to his mistakes. And he hasn't owned up to all of them. And sometimes he was just blowing hot air, but sometimes it was real, and it was real remorse. And I think that's rare. And so I think you can mourn the character of the person that was lost while still disagreeing with their politics.
Yeah. I mean, I was telling you earlier, one of my favorite quotes on this sort of topic is actually from Daredevil, the Marvel comic. But what the priest says something to the effect of, nothing shines up a halo faster than death. And that makes sense, right? When someone dies and you mourn them and they pass and you talk about all the great things they did. And I think that's an important part of mourning. I don't think you need to, I don't think you need to laud every part of the person. But I do think that someone like John McCain, who served his country for 60 years in the armed services, in Congress, in the Senate, he was a two-time presidential candidate. He wasn't the greatest man who ever lived, but I think that we can recognize and acknowledge his service and what he did for this country, in addition to the things that we disagreed with or things that he did were wrong. And like you said, he was one of the politicians that would own up to his failings, not every time, not perfectly. And, you know, not that's not to say that he's like this amazing model politician, but, you know, he was a man who served this country. And I think that that is worth honoring. And I also think it's worth looking at Trump's response to this in addition to put it in sort of larger context, because no matter what, no matter who John McCain was, you know, the protocol says when a senator or congressperson passes, you fly the flag half mast. And there are certain things that you put in place to honor the people that serve this country. And for Donald Trump to just, he wouldn't put out a statement. He finally did put out a statement. And he finally did lower the flags. But, you know, it was definitely, the statement he put out was obviously written by a staffer. Like, there was no heart in it. And again, you can disagree with John McCain on policy and you can refute this maverick title, which I still vehemently do. He was no fucking maverick, but he was a man who served this country and who deserves the respect of the president of the United States, because that's what we do. We put a lot of importance on that in this country, and it's important.
Yeah, and reasonable people like who are listening to this can disagree and be like, no, you know, you should remember his legacy in full from day one. And again, you can disagree with me on that, and I think you should, and I think a lot of people were doing that. None of the eulogies I read were ignoring the fact or trying to hide the fact that he nominated Sarah Palin to be the vice president, or he picked her for his vice presidential candidacy. No one was hiding the fact, or no one forgets the fact that he was a cheerleader for the Iraq War and really advocated for it. And no one forgets the fact that he was an avid supporter of military intervention abroad as many times as I can count, right? Like, no one forgets that, and no one is going to forget that a week from now, 2 weeks from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, when they're writing their biographies or they're writing their histories of this period. They're not going to, you know, rehash this line that, you know, John McCain was a maverick because of one day the country mourned. It's not going to happen, right? And so there's a way to, you don't have to even admire it. There's a way to find the good in somebody and emulate that good and then acknowledge the bad. And it's and then there's also like, I just want to be like very clear, like there's also a way to say what I'm saying right now without being like, I'm going to tone police you. I'm going to, you know, insist that you're a heartless monster. No, I don't think you are. If you're going to focus on his legacy and focus on the stuff that you disagreed with, that is a fair and valid feeling. But at the same time, this is my fair and valid feeling as well.
Right. And also, I just want to reiterate that a lot of what I'm feeling about this is actually has more to do with Trump and his response and his absolute pettiness and smallness and the fact that he's turned this into something that's about all about him. Like he wanted to send out a brief tweet and nothing else. And that's just not how it's done. And again, we have to keep calling that out or this will be normalized. And I think that, again, no matter what you think or thought of John McCain and or all of the eulogies or how we remember this man, he was still a person who served. He was still a person who deserves the respect of the president. And I know that's a tall order when our president is obviously the least respectful person who has maybe ever walked this planet. But I think it's important to keep calling that out and to keep reminding people that this is not normal and it is not okay.
Yeah. And I just want to read a tiny bit from McCain's farewell letter, which I thought was beautiful and people can disagree. But basically he said, "Fellow Americans, that association has meant more to me than any other. I lived and died a proud American. We are citizens of the world's greatest republic, a nation of ideals, not blood and soil." And so that in and of itself is just a clear explanation of America's ideals or what we hope to achieve, what we strive to achieve every day is that we're a republic and we're a nation of ideals and that we are proud of our country, but we are not a nation of blood and soil, which is basically referencing, you know, Nazi propaganda, which is very much jingoistic, nationalistic, racist, right? And it's a very clear indication of what he believed in his whole life. And he might not have achieved that, right? But that's what he wanted to strive to. And I believe that. I believe that he wanted to be in service of America and America that he thought was a nation of ideals, right? But what's really messed up is that reading this whole thing, I could not get Trump out of my head because this whole thing read like a criticism of Trump. Because at the end it said, you know, "Do not despair of our present difficulties, but believe always in the promise and greatness of America, because nothing is inevitable here. Americans never quit. We never surrender. We never hide from history. We make history." Again, if I could have like a mind, like eternal spotless sunshine of the world, like machine, I could erase my memory and I had no memory of Donald Trump and I read this, I'd be like, America sounds great. It sounds awesome. This guy sounded like a good guy. Right. But because I have Trump on my brain 24/7, all I was reading into this was Trump. And I felt bad about that because this is just a common call to arms that any politician would say to their fellow Americans. So that was like my feelings. It's like I felt like we were allowed to mourn the character of this person while still not letting go of our principles as principled Democrats. But at the same time, you know, it sucks that everything is so Trump faded right now.
If and when, obviously, a Democratic senator dies, I want them to be treated with respect, no matter who the president is. And I think that the concept of respect here is more important than anything else.
Yeah, it's not asking for like a fake civility. Like there's just like a level of decency, a level of respect. That doesn't mean you have to be silent and no one is going to tell you to be silent.
I think that our president has taken a situation and made it about him and made it disgusting. And that is what makes me very, very angry.
Okay, Devin, what's the latest news when it comes to the shooting that just happened in Jacksonville, Florida?
This was on Sunday, so yesterday, at a video game tournament in Jacksonville, Florida. The shooter was identified. He shot two other people and himself, so three total are dead and an additional 11 are injured. Like we said, from the reporting, they don't have like a firm motive yet. They're not really sure, but ultimately it doesn't really matter. This is just the latest mass shooting. And it's disgusting that I can say that. It's disgusting that this is almost normal. It's almost like, oh, you know, when Varsha texted me and sent me as soon as the news broke, and I read the thing, and I was like, oh, only three people died. I'm not kidding. That was my first thought.
Yeah.
And that's disgusting.
I was so grateful that I saw this like happening over Twitter, and I was like, oh, thank God, only three people died. And it's so horrific that that is the frame of reference that we have right now, because what we're thinking is the more massive shootings that have happened in our recent memory that we've forgotten about. Like, people have basically forgotten about Las Vegas. It's just, we've forgotten about the fact that like hundreds of people were shot at. And so this is just like a latest in a series, but it's just more proof that the GOP, and specifically people who are just apathetic about gun laws, have done nothing. They really have done nothing. There has been an increase in state laws across the country since Parkland. There has been more activism. The people who actually hold power have not changed anything. They've not changed their views. They've not done more to understand the situation. They've basically ignored it. And they think that they can continue doing this. And it's unacceptable. And I want people to remember that November is coming soon. And that if anyone votes for anyone with a higher than F rating from the NRA, recheck your ballot. You know, like, just double check that. Make sure you are not voting for anyone who has a good rating from the NRA, because fuck the NRA, fuck gun manufacturers, and fuck the GOP for continuing to make us believe that the Second Amendment means that we can never have any common gun control. Because at this point, gun control is not a fucking policy choice. It's not a fucking policy position. It's a public safety issue.
Exactly. I mean, I've talked about this with Shannon Watts multiple times on this show. But the fact that the CDC isn't even allowed to study gun violence as a public health issue says a lot about the power of the gun lobby and the power of these industries that have been able to keep gun violence away from the CDC as a public health issue. Because also buried in this little New York Times, not little, but buried in this New York Times article about the Jacksonville, Florida shooting at this gaming tournament was this line, quote, "Jacksonville was already reeling from another deadly shooting over the weekend. One person was killed and two others were injured in a shooting after a high school football game on Friday." So in Jacksonville, Florida, in less than a weekend, four people were killed and two were injured from gun violence. And, you know, again, Florida is where Parkland was. You know, they've been devastated by gun violence. They have such lax gun laws. It's disgusting. And nothing seems to be moving them to change. And then Governor Scott said something, and it really rubbed me the wrong way. He said, quote, "We have got to change. We've got to really stop and say to ourselves, there's something wrong. Why are young men willing to give up their lives? Or why don't they value someone else's life? We've got to figure this out. We don't ever want this to happen again." That just struck me as the wrong question.
Yeah. The thing is, it's part of a right question. It's part of like the bigger question that should be answered. There's multiple questions when you're coming to like public policy and gun violence. It's like, there's the issue of like mass shootings. There's the issue of like, hey, Twitter spent like 2 hours resharing an audio file of the mass shooting, and it probably triggered and thousands of people, but also it may have contributed to a possible copycat effect. I'm not saying it's like it's going to happen. I'm saying we're memorializing that these people. That's like one thing, is like we're memorializing these mass shooters. Another question is part of what Rick Scott said, even though he's putting it wrong. EMRAZZ, Emraz on Twitter, said it the best, and I'm just going to quote her tweet. "When a young man responds to his loss in a video game tournament by calmly gunning down his competitors, there's a problem with violent male entitlement and the coping mechanisms normalized by its toxicity. Somebody had to say it. Don't at me. I am going to at you, Emraz, because you're 1,000% correct." Rick Scott, even though he's not saying it because he doesn't want to say it, because that would be a totally different conversation, there is a problem with toxic masculinity here, because the background of a mass shooter is usually white and male, and usually pretty young, at the very least white and male. That means there's a problem with not just how easy they're getting access to guns, but also how we're dealing with the aftermath, how we're dealing with you know, teaching young men about refusals and not refusals, because like the biggest aspect of gun violence is rarely talked about is domestic violence. Gun deaths is a result of domestic violence.
Well, domestic violence and violence against women is the straightest line between most of these mass shootings.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And these sort of, you know, sort of incidents. And again, I don't have any more information on this other Jacksonville, Florida shooting from Friday at the high school, but the mayor of Jacksonville said that it was, quote, gang violence related. And I have a feeling that that is not exactly as nuanced as we would like it to be in terms of what happened there. I would put money on the fact that there was some sort of domestic violence or violence against a woman involved in that shooting. And they're chalking it up to something else. And I think you're right, Varsha. You know, Scott is getting at one of the most important questions here. I guess what rubbed me the wrong way is it felt like that's not the question. Yeah. And that's not the question he was asking in that context. I think he was asking it more like, oh, mental health is the bigger issue here. And I'm not saying mental health is not something that we should talk about, because I, more than a lot of people, think that mental health is one of the biggest issues facing our country that we have to talk about. But it's not, it's a part of, but not inextricably linked to gun violence. Just because you have a mental illness does not make you any more likely to be violent or to commit gun violence. And I feel like the two get very crossed in terms of the way we talk about them and the way we think about them.
As a social science major, I'll just say, like, correlation is not fucking causation. So, like, just because we can argue credibly that a lot of mass shooters or shooters in general may have a mental illness or a history of mental illness does not mean that that is the reason they picked up a gun and shot someone. And even if it is, the solution is to either give more money for mental health care and to reduce the number of guns. But the GOP doesn't want to do either, right? So, like, that's the problem with Rick Scott. And I think that's maybe why it rubbed me the wrong way, too, is because I remember reading that and I was just like, yeah, but you're not going to do anything to help these men. Even if you're making maybe a sound argument about how men are, you know, dying at a pretty high rate because they're willing to shoot other people, doesn't mean you're, like, making a solid argument about it, because you're not going to help with mental health, even if you think mental health is the problem, which I don't think it's the main problem, but...
Right. Well, and why are young men willing to give up their lives? I mean, that, again, just seems like an odd way to phrase that question, because the bigger question to me is, first of all, what makes these men, if they're willing to give up their own lives, what makes them want to kill other people in addition to that? And then also, why is it so easy to access these weapons that would even be a possibility on the table?
And why is it so easy to assume that all of these people, all of these shootings that we've had in the past 10, whatever years, are all isolated, right? So if you're going to make a correlation between mental health and mass shootings, make a correlation between one mass shooter and another mass shooter, or one shooter and another shooter, or one gun culture and male culture, right? So, like, make those correlations. Why aren't you making those connections, Rick Scott?
And, you know, the other thing is that Rick Scott isn't even going to be the governor. He's running for Senate in Florida. And so he's made no firm policy, you know, suggestions or policy moves of any kind. So it just is so frustrating. And, you know, I want to talk about another kind of gun policy issue. Betsy DeVos and the Education Department is trying to use federal money to buy firearms for schools. And I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing because the way she's trying to do it is with a bill from 2015 called Every Student Succeeds Act. And the Every Student Succeeds Act basically provides money and lays out a three-part plan for improving public schools toward these three goals: providing well-rounded education, improving school conditions for learning, and improving the use of technology for digital literacy. So that's what the money
is. And states can decide how their states,
how
states can use money for these three conditions, but they could also ask the department, hey, I want to do this cool, innovative new idea, which usually is meant to be like, I want to buy iPads for a certain classroom and run a pilot program. Instead, it's, I want to arm teachers in kindergarten classes. And Betsy DeVos, you got to say yes to this. And Betsy's like, let's do a review of this. Maybe we could say yes.
What's fascinating about this is that the reason why they're trying to use this bill is because it does not specifically prohibit the money for use on firearms, which I didn't know was even a thing that we had to discuss. I did not realize that that was something that we had to define in our terms. So I think for me, that's why it was so surprising. I didn't realize that education bills either had to or should include language that excludes the purchase of firearms from the spending. And yeah, so, you know, they're saying that it could technically be used as the first part. So the improving school conditions. That's the argument that they're making. And the fact that Betsy DeVos, my personal arch nemesis, is even giving this 1 second of actual thought or time from the education department is absolutely so disappointing. I mean, it's not surprising, but it is disappointing.
And I am so grateful that, like, Senator Murphy has introduced an amendment that would block the Department of Education from doing this, from using Title IV funds to purchase firearms for teachers. And I'm happy he's doing it. I'm just sad that we live in a point in a country where the federal government thinks, or just any government thinks, hey, we don't have enough money, or we say we don't have enough money to pay teachers or buy them school supplies or update our textbooks or, you know, actually desegregate our schools, but let's buy some teachers some guns.
I just don't understand, you know, and it is frustrating because it also goes to show that when you leave room for flexibility, right, by saying, hey, states, you can come up with other cool, interesting ideas that we haven't thought of. Let's get some innovation going together. And then Texas, because of course it's Texas, comes back with, I want $62 million to arm teachers, that's the kind of innovation that we're coming up with. And I feel like this story ties in with this Jacksonville shooting in kind of an odd way, because it speaks to the way as a society that we view mm-hmm. guns, and the reason why I think we can't come to any consensus on common sense gun reform is because we don't see them as dangerous. We don't see them as something that needs to be regulated. We see them as something that is part of our normal everyday life. And that's just not normal, right? Like when the first question the Governor Scott asks is, why are these men willing to give up their lives? And then the question in front of the education department is, should we use federal money to arm teachers? I mean, I think those two questions are coming from a similar understanding of our gun
problem
culture.
Fundamentally for the GOP, and maybe for a lot of people, like, even though a lot of people support common sense gun reform, like universal background checks, stuff like that, the problem for the GOP and maybe more people is that they think that because guns are written into the Constitution or whatever, there's no fundamental way to allow us to regulate them. But also, because they were in the Constitution, it must mean that, like, we are, like, intrinsically some gun type culture. No, we're not. Like, this was created. This type of gun culture that we have was fundamentally, like, created and built in the 20th century to encourage, like, to increase gun sales, to increase the NRA's coffers, to help GOP members get elected. It wasn't like this gun culture wasn't created because, like, a bunch of Democrats of, like, 50 years ago were like, let's confiscate all the guns. No, no one ever said that. It was like it was manufactured just as every other type of culture is manufactured. Nothing, like, erupts from, like, the ether. And this is, like, given to us, like, you know, whatever supreme being was like, America will be the gun country. No.
Right, exactly. That doesn't have to be the thing, but that's how we view ourselves. Even people who are for common sense gun reform, I think there's this approach that, like, there's something uniquely American about guns, and it has a lot to do with the Second Amendment. But the Second Amendment has been interpreted, like you said, by the NRA, by gun manufacturers, by specific groups to make this sort of gun culture uniquely American. But that doesn't mean that it's somehow sanctioned by the constitutional powers that be. I mean,
we can change views all the time. Sometimes, like, we really do. Because, like,
exactly.
You know, like, fucking exactly. Brett Kavanaugh wants to overturn, like, 70 years of precedent. Like, fuck it. I will overturn the fucking Second Amendment if I have to, right? Like, and so, I mean, I also think the way these two stories connect is to show how popular knowledge, or I think maybe reception of these shootings has shifted a little bit because of Parkland. I do think that when these two stories came out, there was more of an uproar than normal, I think. I am not saying that, like, you know, other mass shootings don't get the same kind of coverage, or, you know, other times this type of policy wouldn't get the same type of coverage. I'm just saying, like, I felt like it was like there was a bigger consensus around the fact that this is bananas. This is just banana stuff. And that could be a good sign.
Well, I think it could also speak to another way in which we shift and move our culture forward. Right now, to a lot of people, the idea of arming teachers sounds bananas. But 15, 20 years ago, the thought of having a agency like ICE was also bananas. So things can become standard very quickly. And things can become ingrained very quickly. And so if we're not careful and we start arming teachers in 15 or 20 years, people are going to think it's unconscionable to have unarmed teachers. That's how quickly the consciousness will change.
I think that's like the big problem with the Betsy DeVos story. Like, even giving credence to this, even though it's normal process, or that's what they say, is like it's normal process to review any and all like requests and stuff like that. Even like normally reviewing this, treating it as if it's literally a safe idea, is problematic. Treating it as if it has equal credence as another educational idea that actually fits within the confines of the bill, that's what's bananas here. And that's what's dangerous here, is like, maybe this won't end up happening. Maybe some Republicans will be like, yeah, you know, arming teachers is probably not smart, and they'll vote with this amendment. But if even if it doesn't end up happening, the fact that we've been talking about this since Parkland is the possibility of arming teachers is a real shift in the Overton window. You're right. It's like, it's amazing how the NRA has been able to take a massive shooting and a massive movement against gun violence and for gun control and turn it into, what if the solution was giving more guns to people? And that is scary. I agree with that. That is really scary.
Right. And again, that's why I think it's important to talk about these kind of stories, because, yeah, maybe it seems laughable now, but it might not seem laughable mm-hmm. in 15 years. So, Varsha, you're basically still a college student, right?
No, I'm a grad student.
Oh, you're a grad student. Do you live in a dorm?
No, I mean, I've had my own apartment for a while now. I still have roommates, but it's...
You have a shitty apartment in Berkeley with a bunch of roommates?
Basically. That's my life. It'll be my life for a while. It'll be my life for a while. I am so close to not being an adult. Like, there's only, like, parts of me that are really good at being adult. They're like, I'm not great at adulting, okay?
Okay, but even though you're not great at adulting, and I'm not either, you can actually have really nice sheets.
Oh, yeah. That's a requirement. I mean, the thing is, like, if I'm not going to have a proper sleep schedule, at least when I go to sleep, I want to sleep real nice.
So we actually found this new company called Brooklinen, and they basically are making luxury sheets and selling them without the luxury markup. So they're very affordable for their set, and you get extra pillowcases, and they're super soft and comfortable. And Hellions get an exclusive offer. So you can get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code Hellbent at brooklinen.com. Plus, Brooklinen is so sure that you're going to love your new sheets that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters, which is awesome, because that gives you some time to figure out if you want really nice sheets in your shitty Berkeley apartment.
Exactly.
Varsha.
Exactly. I mean, the best part about the site is, like, it just looks so nice that you can, like, choose between the different types they have. Like, they have, like, their linen ones. Linen sheets, not going to lie, they're great to sleep on, because they're just, especially in California
nice
weather.
And cool.
Okay. So
I know. It's really great. It's really great. And I have all sorts of really cute patterns, and they actually will make your room look like it might be an adult room, even if it's not, because you're me and you're not actually an adult.
Exactly. Because, like, I'm not paying the 300% markup for regular sheets. So if I'm going to get nice sheets, I might as well get them at Brooklinen, because I look like an adult, but I'm not spending money like an adult.
And we're not actually adults. And the only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code Hellbent at brooklinen.com. That's BROOKLINEN.com with promo code Hellbent. Brooklinen. These really are the best sheets ever.
Fuck yeah.
Okay, Varsha, so something super interesting happened with healthcare. A group of Republican senators proposed legislation that would purportedly protect the pre-existing conditions clause in the ACA. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Basically, Texas, again, is suing over the fact that the healthcare law is unconstitutional, right? And it's they're basically saying because the individual mandate was repealed, now the whole bill is unconstitutional. Because back when back in 2010, when the law was defended, John Roberts was like, hey, the individual mandate is like a tax, therefore this law is constitutional. Now, that's like a really simple explanation. Now they're saying, now that the Republicans repealed the individual mandate in the tax bill, this whole bill is unconstitutional. And that's bananas. Me not being a lawyer knows that's bananas. But the Trump administration has actually sided with the suing states, and they're just like, yeah, this federal law is unconstitutional. Fuck it. I'm not going to defend it. And that's bananas. And so the Republicans are like, oh, this doesn't make us look good. So 10 Senate Republicans have introduced legislation that they say is going to prohibit insurers from turning away people with pre-existing conditions. But obviously,
there's always a but.
There's always a shoe to drop. Republicans are lying. Shocker, I know. Take a seat if you were shocked. It says like an insurer would have to give you insurance if you have a pre-existing condition, but it could include any specific services that are associated with a pre-existing condition. The actual protection for pre-existing conditions would be a mirage. There's like a loophole in the fucking law where they're just like, yeah, like you're going
to
say.
Introducing a law to introduce this loophole. It is fucking ridiculous.
It really
I almost couldn't believe it. They're literally saying, they're calling it the protections for pre-existing conditions, blah, blah, blah. I don't care. And literally it says that you cannot deny someone coverage based on their pre-existing condition, but you can totally exclude coverage for treatments that apply to that a pre-existing condition. So for whatever reason, if my pre-existing condition said I needed physical therapy, they could not deny me insurance because I need physical therapy for something, but they could deny me physical therapy.
You're pretending that you're protecting pre-existing conditions instead of just actually leaving well enough alone and telling the Trump administration to get off its ass and defend Obamacare. Like at this point, Obamacare is like, it's like Obamacare, it's like 70% there, because like 30% is gone because of the individual mandate, and it could keep deteriorating. We don't know. It's doing pretty okay. It's survived a lot of thousand cuts. Like it's survived even after these cuts, but we don't know if it could still be there in like 2 or 3 years. We don't know how the market is going to continue reacting to the sabotage that the Trump administration is doing. But at this point, a senator who has like a better knowledge of the polls in their state should realize that almost every person wants better health care. There's two reasons this is bad. One is bad is because you should never vote for the GOP. They clearly don't care for you. And another reason this is bad is because they truly think their constituents are morons, right? And that's so disrespectful. So like on a principled level, you shouldn't be voting for these people because they think that you're not going to pay attention to this. They think that you don't understand what they're doing, but you do, because it's clear in this Bloomberg article. It's clear as day. You could read it in any article. It'd be clear as day. It would come out if this bill actually went to the floor, right? And right. So that's what's just so disrespectful about this is, one, they're just doing whatever they can to gut healthcare, even though at this point.
Well, yeah. And they know that any attacks on it is just, you know, cutting themselves, because with the midterms coming up, healthcare is always a hot button issue.
Yeah.
And already, you know, the Cook Political Report is predicting a 20 to 40 seat House Democrat pickup, which means, first of all, right now, Democrats only need 24 seats to win back the majority. And 25 of the Republican seats that are up voted for Hillary Clinton. Those districts voted for Hillary Clinton. And now Cook is saying between a 20 to 40 seat pickup. Republicans are scared shitless. They don't know what to do with their hands. That's how scared they are.
Yeah. And all Paul Ryan is like saying is like, look, the tax cuts are working. Literally, you ask him any fucking question, I bet you that's his answer. Look, the tax cuts are working, even though they fucking aren't. But that's a whole other story. But yeah, you're exactly right. It's like they don't want to make a big hullabaloo over this new healthcare bill that they're proposing, even if it doesn't go to the floor. And they don't want people talking about this lawsuit the Trump administration is siding with Texas on, because they know it's going to it's going to hurt them even more. And so obviously the Cook Political Report isn't like a crystal ball. They can't read the future. They can't tell the future. But what it does say is that we have a really good fighting chance. And it shows that if we fight on stuff like healthcare and taxes and the fact that the GOP has like a culture of corruption just oozing around it, we could pick up 40 seats, which would be amazing. And so that means it takes hard work. And that means it takes reading stories like this and being enraged because motherfuckers, these people are just like, they literally, I just have to repeat it one more time for people to understand. They say the bill protects pre-existing conditions because you can buy insurance from it and you won't be denied. But the actual treatment you would need just like to solve your pre-existing condition isn't covered. What the fuck? What the fuck? I can't.
Exactly. And just the one action, this one piece of legislation, you know, I read it. The first thing I thought without having any additional information was these guys know they're fucked.
Yeah.
That's why they're doing it. They know that they need something, anything, not just a Hail Mary, but like a whole goddamn church full of Hail Marys. And so they tried this and it's kind of like, oh, honey, good try, but no.
No.
Because we see you. And that's the thing. And that is actually giving me a little bit of hope right now. You know, of all the gaslighting, all the bullshit out of the White House, you know, all the bullshit about Trump wanting to pardon Manafort and Mike going rogue and do it and all this other stuff. In all of that, they've jumped the shark to the point where you can just now see it. And maybe that's enough. Maybe that's a start. I don't know.
I think it is. I'm like in a combination. Like I have, you know how like people have combination skin? I have like combination attitude about like politics. Where like at times I feel really optimistic and like I listen to podcast episodes about how it's the year of the women and all this stuff. And I'm just like, I'm in tears half the time. And at other times I'm just like deeply like nothing matters. Everything is death. Like it's all horrible. But like I think the combination of the fact that this bill is just so bad and the Trump administration has been handling healthcare so bad with like the uproar over the fact that they've been doing all this horrible shit is like it's like a combination feeling where I'm just like I feel bad for people who might be risking their healthcare or who like feel afraid for their healthcare, but I also feel amazed at the fact that we're fighting back. So I really do have a combination attitude towards this.
All right, Varsha, last but not least, let's talk about the failed voter suppression attempt in Georgia. So basically, there was this effort to close 7 polling places in a majority black area of Georgia. This was because of Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, who's actually now a candidate for governor against the amazing Stacey Abrams, Brian Kemp, and he was the one who was trying to do this. So it was definitely an effort to suppress the vote. And again, this wasn't even subtle.
It really wasn't. They basically were just like, yeah, let's just close this stuff, right? But then, like, it failed hilariously. So the consultant basically proposed this idea, right? And they rejected this proposition in less than 60 seconds. And the consultant, Mike Malone, was like, hey, the consolidation is an effort to save money. And the Randolph County Board was just like, no.
Didn't they also try to say it was like they weren't disability accessible? And so they were trying to bring them up to code and they were giving all of these reasons. I mean, it was like, they were like just throwing shit at the wall to see what would stick.
They really were. They really were throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what would stick because they were just like, oh yeah, this violates the ADA and we don't have the funds to fix them by November and we can't have bad polling places. And you're just like, shut the fuck up. Like, oh my God. And the reason this is just important is because it's just a really blatant attempt at voter suppression. And yes, it failed. But the Georgia election for governor is going to be really, really tough. And this is going to be one of the main ways it's tough. One of the main reasons it's tough is because Brian Kemp, the guy, Stacey Abrams' opponent, has basically been doing this his whole time when he's Secretary of State. He is like one of the main architects of a lot of voter suppression tactics in Georgia. And Stacey Abrams' campaign is like central to reversing them and protecting the right to vote. But it's going to be an uphill battle. And like this one aspect may have won, and it was hilarious, and it was great that we that these 7 polling places aren't going to be closed, but it could have gone the other way. We have no idea, right? We don't know how much power Brian Kemp and the GOP is going to be able to inflict when it comes to upholding voting suppression tactics.
It's just the fact that it was so blatant.
Yeah.
That there's something just vaguely disturbing on top of all of the other disturbing parts of this. But the fact that it was just so cavalier and they were like, yeah, we're totally going to get away with this. Because normally they do. It just is so indicative of why the gubernatorial race in Georgia is so important. I mean, think about it. Stacey Abrams would be the first Black woman in a governorship ever. It is 2018. It is absolutely bananas that we've never had a Black woman in a governorship. And the fact of the matter is that while Brian Kemp is running against this highly qualified Black woman who's garnered all sorts of national attention, who knows what she's talking about, and he still attempts to shut down 7 polling places in majority Black areas, just, again, the blatancy. It's so autocratic, really. I can't stop thinking about Sarah Kendzior and saying how blatancy is part of autocracy, because you have to shove it in people's faces that you can break all the rules. Otherwise, what's the point of doing it?
Yeah. And I like that he tried to like flip flop on this, because like we don't actually know like how involved he was in the original effort, Kemp, right? But he, in the end, he was like, oh shit, I'm actually in, like, the polls are pretty competitive, I'm gonna denounce this plan. But I love the state elections director, his letter to the to a member of the Randolph Elections Board. Basically, the letter was just like, you have created a national media spectacle by seeking to make major changes right before an election and failing to act in a decisive manner that is responsive to the demands of voters in Randolph County. And like, Harvey's just like, dude, if you're gonna suppress the vote, can you at least be better about it? Like, why did you do this so badly? I don't know like on which side Chris Harvey is on when it comes to suppressing the vote and this tactic, but at the very least, there was a really sassy letter where he was just like, dude, this was a major fail. Major own.
Whether or not Kemp says that he was involved or denounces or not, he's the Secretary of State currently, and all of this shit is under his purview, and I'm not letting him off the hook. I don't care. Again, maybe it's a little tinfoil hat hair of me, but no, there's no fucking way that you hire an election consultant in a state without running it by the Secretary of State. That's not how this works.
Especially because like you're hiring like a GOP consultant, right? Like you're
exactly
like you knew what the guy was going to propose before you hired him. That's why you tried to hire him, or that's why you hired him. It's like you knew the kind of policies he'd propose, right? There's no way you hired him because he was nonpartisan. Like, what the fuck?
Please spare me your bullshit narrative, and I like forget it.
But basically, vote Stacey Abrams in November and volunteer for her and donate to her campaign, because this shit is going to keep happening.
It is going to keep happening. And also, Stacey Abrams is one of my favorite human beings. And I can say that pretty soundly. I know I talk about all the time how we interviewed her last summer, but she is to this day my favorite interview I've ever done on this show.
Okay, Devin, what are you grateful for this week?
Well, first, I can finally tell y'all that I am so grateful for these projects that we've been working on. And it is so exciting. And it is so cool. And Varsha, you're an amazing producer as well. And we've just been kicking ass and taking names.
So much fun.
Yeah. So we're producing 3 shows for the next 90 days. It's fine. No one needs sleep. Sleep is for the weak. but I also am grateful for something, an article in the New York Times of all places. But it was an article about the gender chore gap in kids at home. Oh. So basically, there was this study that found that the pay gap and the job gap basically starts at home. Girls have more chores than boys and get paid less to do those same chores.
What?
And so that's not what I'm grateful for, because obviously that's fucking awful.
Oh my God.
So that's fucking awful. But what I am grateful for is that there's actually a lot of very interesting research on this. The first step in solving a problem is to name it, is to find it, right?
Yeah.
So basically, not only do boys do less work, but they are also paid more allowance than girls for doing chores. So there's this analysis of 10,000 families that use an app called Busy Kid, which is like a chore app. And I guess you can use it to like pay your kids, and which is interesting and things I haven't even thought about dealing with being a parent these days. But it found, this analysis found, that boys using the app earned twice what the girls did for doing chores. Boys earned an average of $13.80 a week compared with girls' $6.71. And boys are also more likely to be paid for personal hygiene, like taking a shower or brushing your teeth. And girls are more likely to be paid for cleaning. So again, I'm not grateful for this because this blows. But I am grateful that this information is out there. And it really gave me a lot to think about because I don't think this is necessarily something that anyone tries to do. And it's so ingrained and so subconscious that the way you treat your male and female children are different. It's so fascinating. And it's something that I have to just be so careful with myself, you know, because I only have the one male child. I want to make sure that I'm not part of this larger perpetuation of something like this. Because it also reflects too, when you get older and you know, we talk about like the split in marriages or cohabitating couples when, you know, there's a male and female partner. Married men, it's actually shifted. Married men now spend 1.1 hours a day on housework, up from 55 minutes in 1983. And married women's time spent on chores has decreased. It's down from 3.8 hours to only 2.2 hours, but that's still double what men are doing. I mean,
still progress,
and again, these roles, it's still progress, exactly, which I'm grateful for. And it's just interesting that it mirrors what we're doing to children, too.
Yeah.
So it's very fascinating. And again, not grateful that it's happening, but I am grateful that, you know, there are shifts being made and we know about this.
Yeah.
So, Varsha, what are you grateful for?
I'm grateful for two things. One, I'm grateful for Serena Williams being the badass that she is. I feel like people probably have like seen this story go around and people know what I'm talking about. But basically, like when I my parents watched a lot of tennis and they still do. And so like I grew up watching Serena Williams and she's amazing. She is clearly the best athlete we have right now in 2018. She has been for a while. But basically she gave birth, right? And she had a daughter and she was very like candid in an amazing interview about how like she had a lot of health issues in giving birth, like blood clots, stuff like that. And so after coming back to tennis after giving birth is, first of all, amazing. But second of all, she has to have like a special like form-fitting suit to make sure to prevent blood clots. And the French Open, the head of the French Open guy was just like, I don't know if this really shows respect for the game. So I'm not going to allow you to wear this. And like the reason I'm grateful for Serena Williams is that she was doing an interview about this and somebody asked her, hey, like, are you like, like, is this still being a problem or something like that? And she's like, no, we still have a good relationship. And she joked it off by saying, you don't want to be repetitive in your wardrobe anyway. And I was like, such class. But also, like, fuck people who are just like, this has no respect for the game. Women and men wear really skimpy shit when they are playing tennis. Trust me, like men and women, right? And so like a form-fitting suit, which is medically necessary for her to be the best goddamn tennis player in the world, it is like important. And so I'm grateful for her. And the second thing I'm grateful for is Vox Explained. It's like a Netflix show and it has a bunch of different topics each week. But they recently did an episode on the female orgasm. And again, like I knew most of the stuff going in. It was interesting to see the statistics around the fact that heterosexual women, women in a relationship, not in a relationship, lesbian women may have different levels of orgasms and like the studies around that, but also the history of stuff of how we've just like been ignoring this issue for so long and not really studying it because we don't actually know a lot about female orgasms, really, like the specifics of stuff. And so it was just a fascinating episode and I'm really happy I watched it. It was really cool and I'm grateful for that.
I really like that show.
It's a great show. And the cricket episode was also amazing because I love cricket and it was all about India and cricket. And I was like, yes.
You love cricket?
I love cricket. People who are from formerly colonized countries, Devin, where the British Empire colonized
us. Cricket.
The British Empire colonized us and they were just like, you should love cricket. And so we were socialized to love cricket. And again, like, I'm not saying I watch it every day, but if it's on, I will watch it. That's a-
All right, Varsha. So, who is our dickwad of the week?
Our dickwad of the week, without most people won't be surprised, is congressional Republicans. And before I get into the story, I just want to like read this headline and like let people like think about it for a couple seconds. Republicans secretly study their coming hell. What an amazing headline, right? So Axios writes this headline and the story to go with it, right? And basically, a bunch of Republicans created a spreadsheet where it says it has a list and it has a preview of every investigation Democrats would likely launch if they flip the House in November. And it's just fucking hilarious because first you read it through and you're just like, oh my God, they really think all this stuff is like stuff they shouldn't investigate. And then the second time you read it through, you're just like, oh, this is corrupt as fuck. But basically the list of these investigations include...
Well, it's just fascinating that they, first of all, wrote it all down.
Yeah.
Like, it's the like, first rule.
Here are all the crimes that have been done and we swept under the rug.
Like, that just makes you a bad criminal, which, okay. But no, it's so fascinating because you just have to think, like, the kind of – they don't have any long game.
They really don't.
That's always been the problem. Since 2016 and Trump won the White House in this, like, weird dystopian future that we're now living in, and there was total Republican control in all three branches of government – or, I'm sorry, in House, Senate, and executive. Even the Supreme Court. And with all of that power – they couldn't figure out what to do with it. And on top of that, they have no long game. Like, they're not Diane Bentley, who is still one of my favorite people, like favorite long game players who kept receipts for fucking years and then took down her husband. They are not that. They couldn't even figure out how to keep the lid on this shit for more than 18 months. Because now with the midterms coming, they know, they see what's coming down the pike. They know what's happening. And it's just absolutely incredible that I don't know if I'd wanted to see that list. If I were a congressional Republican, I'd want to be like, you know what? I don't need to see it. It's kind of like, do you really want to know how you die? And then you're like waiting for it. Or you're just kind of like, you know what? Nah, it's cool. I don't need to know.
My favorite tweet was from Brian Schatz, because I love Brian Schatz's tweet. He's a senator from Hawaii. He was like, I like this list. It's a good list. And I was just like, yes. Yes, it is. Because, okay, the list includes Democrats might investigate. It includes President Trump's tax returns, which should have been released on fucking January 20th, 2017. Trump's family business. Yeah, emoluments are a big fucking deal. Trump's dealing with Russia. Yeah. It's a big fucking deal. Stephanie Clifford payment, James Comey firing of U.S. attorneys, the proposed transgender ban, Steve Mnuchin's business dealings. That guy's shady as fuck. White House personal email use. Personal fucking emails. Are you fucking kidding me? Cabinet secretary travel, because multiple cabinet secretaries have travel scandals. Travel related scandals.
More than one.
Yeah.
More than one secretary.
One got fired because of it. Discussion of classified information at Mar-a-Lago, because that's normal. Jared Kushner's ethics law compliance, basically no compliance. Dismissal of members from the EPA and scientific counselors, the EPA Board of Scientific Counselors. That's weird. The travel ban, because again, no process. Family separation policy.
I'm very on board with Brian Schatz's tweets. It's a good list.
It is. It's a good list. And you can just keep going down the line. And, like, there are other stuff to add to this probably. And I'm very excited if Democrats take back the House, this list could become reality. I'm so happy Republicans put it together for us. Thank you.
Together for us. That was so nice of them.
They're the dickwads. Because not only did they make up this list, sorry, I should be more clear. The spreadsheet also includes, like, a list of who Democrats might actually call to talk and to testify, and also like what questions might be asked. And I'm just like, you did all this research instead of just doing the fucking oversight yourself.
I know. It's amazing. It's almost a gratitude check in addition to being a dickwad. Like, I think it's just both now.
At this point it is. Because there's only little moments of joy. And like, so the way the story was framed was like, again, it was like combination politics. I was just like a little bit angry and also like laughing my ass off. Okay, Devin, what are some action items people can do after the show?
Okay, so have a couple for you. One, next week, You're going to download and subscribe to Hellbent Presents Crush the Midterms and Candidate, Real Conversations with Women Running for Office, which are our two new productions and our two new collaborations. So that's going to be amazing. But on a more serious note, we still have fucking problems with kids at the border and kids being separated from their parents. And while the policy is supposedly no longer in effect, the trauma is ongoing and will never stop. I mean, there was a video put out by the ACLU of a mother being reunited with her child, and her child didn't want to hug her or kiss her or, you know, didn't know, like, wouldn't talk to her or look at her and kept walking away. And they were both crying of just pure anguish. And it is disgusting that we have done that to people. So I'm going to direct all of y'all to give more money to Racist Texas. They are providing legal services on the ground to get these families reunited. They do really good work down in Texas. Excuse me. There are all sorts of groups that are working to solve this problem. So they are definitely worth giving your time and attention to.
Definitely.
Yes. Also, with this coming, these new projects and everything, we have launched hellbentmedia.com. It's going to be where all of our shows live and where everything is going to come into one place. And we've also put together a page that if you go to hellbentmedia.com/action, we are going to have links and resources. You can register to vote with the vote.org tools. They're on there. Places you can donate, how you can apply your skills, how you can volunteer for campaigns, and then links to every week's sort of action item at the top, so you'll always know where to find it. So that's hellbentmedia.com/action. And even though I almost cried last week because my beautiful website that I worked so hard on didn't work, we ended up getting it fixed. So all right, Varsha, well, that does it for us. Thank you so much for listening. We're so excited about these new projects. Varsha and I will be back here on Thursday. We have a very special guest. But until then, Hellions, remember to raise some hell
and be compassionate.
Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
We get editing help from Andrew Walsh. And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere.